The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin.
SaferDean, thanks so much for coming on the show and chatting about your book, your work, your travels, Bitcoin in general. It's an honor to have you. I'm really looking forward to jumping in on some of these issues. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Zach. It's going to be fun, I think, talking to you.
The Bitcoin Standard itself has sort of become the standard for Bitcoin maximalism in the space, and it's selling like crazy, being read like crazy. Is this the reception you sort of expected for the book, and how are you processing all of this so far?
I think within Bitcoin inner circles, it's been extremely popular. I wouldn't say it's been selling well on a global or national scale, but that's perfectly fine by me, and this is I was hoping that it would be a good book for Bitcoiners primarily. This was really my target audience, and I didn't really care about the wider public, because I think the important thing about this book is to just offer Bitcoiners a good thing that they could then offer to their friends and family who ask them, you know, why do you care about Bitcoin? This was really my goal from writing this book, so that, you know, the curious, intelligent person who doesn't want to spend months of their lives wading through white papers written by all sorts of people and, you know, getting lost down all sorts of silly altcoin and ICO scams of people who use their knowledge of Bitcoin simply to promote their own shitcoins and second layers and all these secondary scams that are hanging on to Bitcoin. So I wanted it to be this sort of book, and I'm very delighted that Bitcoiners seem to like it so far. I think the last 4 years have been just one big giant confusion and disinformation campaign to try and distract from Bitcoin's importance. I mean, not necessarily that it was premeditated, but the effect of all of these scams proliferating around Bitcoin, you know, all the stupid buzzword orgy that we keep listening to about all these new vaporware applications that do nothing, the effect of it has been to drown out the importance of Bitcoin and to portray Bitcoin in the minds of people as being no different from these silly con artist creations of all the altcoins. You know, it's just like there's now a new stock market, but it's made up of computer programmers making up their own programs that are all trading against each other. And you can enter that stock market and you can bet on one against the other. So it's almost like a horse race or a casino or a stock market all mixed into each other. But, you know, the internet's version of that, and people are just competing by betting on all these different currencies. And that's not the case. There's no comparison between Bitcoin and all the other altcoins, every single one of them, who are all completely pointless and stupid scams, who have been hanging on to Bitcoin's coattails in order to make money for their creators. That's their only purpose. None of them has done anything so far except enrich their creators.
On an earlier episode of this show, actually, Michael Goldstein and I were chatting about the difficulties of entering Bitcoin post 2014, when altcoins sort of started becoming a thing, and then we get ICOs and all of this, because prior to that, there was only Bitcoin. The idea was clear that we are creating sound money, but now newcomers are barraged with untold amounts of nonsense, and the process of arriving at maximalism is so much more difficult, which is why I think your book is so important. It's a simple, clear explanation of what really matters to help them penetrate through all that nonsense. It's much harder for them to be a maximalist now than it was several years ago.
Thank you, Zach. And I think, you know, the point behind writing it as a book and just getting it out there in a static form rather than just putting things in a website is that books last better than websites do because of their physical, final, immutable form, if you want. And so I think, you know, 5-10 years from now, we already have what now, 1,600 shitcoin scams. I think another 5-10 years from now, we might have another 1,600 or 16,000 of them. And so what will become apparent is that, you know, from day one, there was always Bitcoin. And then there's this giant a noise of all these others talking about, oh, no, but we're offering this and that and smart contracts and governance and something or the other. And, you know, every single one of them is going to try to pretend to be the Bitcoin killer. But 10 years from now, there's going to be 10 million or 10,000 Bitcoin killers, but Bitcoin will still be alive. And all of these Bitcoin killers are just going to be eating up each other's share of the suckers who put money into them, and Bitcoin will remain there. So over time, you know, I thought having a book out there that explains what Bitcoin is will be good as a resource, because people will have it in their closet and in their own bookshelves, and other people will pick it up, and it'll just keep this idea that, look, there's this one thing here. No matter how much the others proliferate, you can come and understand what Bitcoin is about, and that's what really matters.
I'm curious if you have a passage or chapter or nugget in the book that's your favorite part of what you wrote out of the entire volume. Is there like a passage that you like more than the rest of the book?
I think this was something that I added really after the book was almost done. So almost in the final copy editing, I think it was in chapter 7 or 8 about the political vision of Bitcoin, or what is the politics behind Bitcoin. And I took a quote from Timothy May describing it, and then another quote from Murray Rothbard about how essentially a capitalist, an anarcho-capitalist society functions. And I think that sort of brought the whole book together. In that it really explained what everything was about. that fundamentally what Bitcoin is that it's a purely voluntary monetary system. So you don't like it, you don't want to use it, that's perfectly fine. But you have to understand that unlike all the government monetary systems that exist out there, Bitcoin doesn't go around shooting people if they don't use it. So the understanding, I think, I thought this is maybe the first time I tell this to anybody, but I think just adding this towards the end brought together all of the economics and all of the politics of this book really well, because it was a quote by Rothbard, whose economics is instrumental to this book. Maybe he's the most, or not maybe, he is the most important economist I've ever read. And this is his political philosophy. So his monetary philosophy and his political philosophy dovetail perfectly. And this passage brings in, for all of the anarchists, sort of shows them how Bitcoin, if you're an anarchist or a libertarian, how Bitcoin fits in with your vision of anarchy and liberty. And for Bitcoiners who are interested in Bitcoin from a monetary perspective, or from people who think that Bitcoin is good money, but are not really sold on the political philosophy of anarchism and libertarianism, this really, I think, ties them all together and shows that the two are inseparable. You can't be a free market. You can't really believe in a free market monetary system without believing in a free society. And you can't believe in a free society without believing in a free market monetary system. And Bitcoin really is the embodiment of those. So if I said the non-aggression principle is the foundation of Rothbard's anarcho-capitalism, and on its basis, any aggression, whether carried out by government or individual, cannot have moral justification. Bitcoin, being completely voluntary and relentlessly peaceful, offers us the monetary infrastructure for a world built purely on voluntary cooperation. Contrary to popular depictions of anarchists as hoodie-clad hoodlums, Bitcoin's brand of anarchism is completely peaceful, providing individuals with the tools necessary for them to be free from government control and inflation. It seeks to impose itself on nobody, and if it grows and succeeds, it will be for its own merits as a peaceful, neutral technology for money and settlement, not through it being forced on others.
I think Bitcoin definitely does. It already is changing. Not only is it changing the idea of how a civilization for centuries have been immersed in soft, weak fiat money, but also a political ideology of anarchy as chaos instead of anarchy as a strictly regulated, structured system that you are free to use or free to not use however you want, but it's the antithesis of chaos.
Yeah, anarchy is order. I mean, the notion of spontaneous order in economics, which Hayek talks about, is a pretty dangerous concept, because once you start thinking about it, you know, markets exist not because your government legislates and allows for a market to exist. Bridges get built and roads and civilization happens not because somebody passes laws that says these things happen. If you think about all of the important social structures that humanity have built, it's fiction to imagine them as being the product of somebody designing them. You know, nobody designed any language out there. English, French, Arabic, Spanish, all of these languages, they don't have a designer. And yet they emerged, and they have very clear, organically emergent rules and order and structure, yet without a single central planner. Similarly, if you think about, say, the market for apples or the market for cars or the market for any good out there, the shape of that market, how it has come to look in terms of who produces how much and what they produce and what they do with it, nobody designed that. There is no single central planner, say, responsible for deciding who gets to buy and sell how much apples. It's all individuals making decisions for themselves. And yet you see the Apple market continues to work and function completely normally. It's a really powerful concept once somebody is able to understand that concept from Friedrich Hayek, and then it begins to eat away at all of the elements of faith you have been indoctrinated with in terms of what your government should be doing. So, you know, some people think the earliest phase is, okay, markets can exist, but they need government regulation. And then you start thinking about it from Hayek's perspective, and you realize that's ridiculous. Government regulation is just there to allow insiders to continue to profit, to allow bureaucrats to make money, to allow people to feel that they are being able to control others in a way that doesn't offend that makes, you know, others who are whose economic success can offend you. So then you can feel that you're putting limits on them. But the notion that, you know, if it wasn't for regulation, we wouldn't have houses or cars or any of that stuff is ridiculous. And then you move on to roads, you start considering whether maybe actually roads are not something that is necessitates the existence of government. And believe it or not, the roads have been built before governments were around. Roads continue to be built outside of the purview of government. And government monopoly on roads is beneficial only to the people in charge of handing out these licenses and building these roads out of taxpayer money without any accountability. So it's just another stupid government monopoly like all the others. Then, you know, you're left with law enforcement and money. Those are the two final big ones that as a sort of person who's beginning to come into contact with libertarian and free market ideas, you know, the last vestige of government control is always money. Well, the next to last, money and then law and order. So for money, you know, a lot of so-called libertarians, particularly in the U.S., are, you know, they would argue for libertarian principles on pretty much anything, but they'll tell you that one important role for government is the provision of a monetary standard. And so, and then that's completely ridiculous. Money was there before governments, and governments adopted gold as money, not because, or governments didn't make gold into money. Governments had to adopt it as money because it was the money of the market. And then they co-opted it. And even after they've replaced it in the hands of people with paper money, that still has not ended the role of gold as money. Gold is still money because central banks themselves still hold it and trade it with one another. And so government is powerless to enforce what money is. Government can't override what the market does. The only thing government can do, which is they're very good at, is just destroy people's lives by giving them terrible forms of money and that are inflationary and that cause hyperinflation and financial crises and recessions and unemployment and all of that. So then, you know, you'd need a little bit of reading of Rothbard and Hayek and Mises and the Austrians, and then you're free of the money aspect. And then you're come to the final level of anarchism, which is law and order. You know, at least we got to have the police, right? Because we can't have a society without police. Because without the police, you know, who would arrest all the 14-year-olds smoking weed out there and keep us safe from all of these, you know, stoned-out 14-year-olds? So generally, of course, no, I'm joking, but there are usually what appear like they're better arguments for why we need the police. But in fact, I'd urge people to read The Ethics of Liberty by Rothbard, and also The Myth of National Defense, or The Private Production of Defense. It's a book by Hans Hermann Hoppe, The Private Production of Defense. I think the other one, The Myth of National Defense, is a collection of essays. But yeah, these will then discuss the concept of how a society, how a free society can provide law and order. And in fact, you know, you see that, I mean, I won't really get into the discussion in much detail, but I'll just say this. If you look around today, anybody who wants actual security is not waiting for the cops, you know. Anybody who has, let's say, a bank or a business that has a lot of value, you hire your own security, you hire your own insurance company, and they come and they will wall off your premises and install cameras, and they will hire their security. And, you know, if you want security, it's still a good, because like with anything else in life, everything, whatever it is, whether it's money, apples, oranges, security, you know, these are nice names that we like to give those things to these goods. Nice names we like to give to these goods that make them sound like they're just, you know, abstract concepts that government can either bestow upon you or take away from you. But in reality, all of these things are just the product of human action. You know, so somebody is out there making the apple for you. Yes, apples grow on their own, but somebody has to plant the tree. Somebody has to spend time making sure the tree is safe from any attackers or whatever. Somebody has to pick the apple, ship it to you, display it. And so, you know, there has to be labor that goes into making an apple. There have to be people who go into producing security as well. And so the notion that we can just have that security be provided better by just putting it in the hands of a monopoly that you can't escape from. You know, instead of having many security providers competing with one another, we just have one security provider. We give it a monopoly, and you have no choice in affecting them in any way except hoping that, you know, you get a vote once every 4 or 5 years, and with that vote, you'll be able to, you know, get a new president in, and if he's a good president, he'll get rid of the bad guys at the police department, and then, you know, hopefully within 15 years or so, they could, you know, make up for you the fact that they abused their position. This isn't how markets work. This is how government monopolies work. They don't work in anything, and they don't work, and they won't work in, and they won't work in private defense. And this is why, you know, people joke about this, and they think this is just unique to their own city, wherever they live. But pretty much everywhere you go, you see the same story, which is the police are not involved in security. They're not. They don't provide security. In fact, I think it was the Supreme Court in the U.S. that ruled in a case that police are not contractually obliged to protect you. The job of the police is to punish the people who commit the crime against you. So they're there for deterrence, but they're not really there to take a bullet for you. So, you know, it's a monopoly job. And when it's a monopoly job, they don't have to do the job properly. They just have to do what gets them to stay in the job. And so you see, you know, the common case of police abuse of the job pretty much everywhere is a feature. It's not a bug. And it's not going to be fixed next week with your election or next year, because you're only going to be electing another politician, no matter who he is. And he's only going to be hiring other policemen to handle that job. It's a monopoly that's rotten from the top down. And so the answer is not to continue to try to play the stupid game of politics and to try and make this monopoly fixed. You know, the way that the Soviet Union managed to fill their shelves with products was not through voting for better communists. It was through getting rid of the central planning apparatus and turning food production into a private good. And that's, I think, the same thing with defense.
And you mentioned governments adopting gold without much of a choice as money instead of creating money out of gold or imposing value on gold. And we've seen governments try to sort of adopt and simultaneously mutilate the idea of a cryptographic money by creating their own nationalized scam coins like El Petro in Venezuela and other governments around the world. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on how you think that plays into the future of Bitcoin as far as governments' attitude towards Bitcoin. I was chatting with Alejandro Machado just yesterday about El Petro in Venezuela, and he's of the opinion, which I wholeheartedly agree with, that governments drawing attention to these shitcoins will likely backfire, given that they will inevitably lose out to Bitcoin, and people who may have interest in other shitcoins or nationalized cryptocurrencies, if you even want to call them a cryptocurrency, we'll show them, all right, this is garbage. Bitcoin is much better. I'm going to use Bitcoin, and the whole thing will backfire. How do you see these nationalized cryptocurrencies playing out in a world with the Bitcoin standard?
I mean, I think the notion that the central banks are going to issue anything like a cryptocurrency is a non-starter, because what separates Bitcoin, and anybody who thinks that that's meaningful is really mistaking what Bitcoin matters for. In other words, people think, you know, Bitcoin matters because it's digital, whereas government money is paper. And that's a huge, huge confusion, because the majority of government money is also digital. The majority of dollars, maybe 80, 90% of dollars, depending on how you count, because hey, nobody counts dollars anymore because, you know, it's too old-fashioned. But the majority of them are not physical. They're just digital ledger entries somewhere or the other. So central banks already have digital currencies. They do have a few pieces of paper outstanding that prevent it from being completely digital. But if they try to take away the pieces of paper to make money completely digital, it's just going to weaken the demand for their money and increase the demand for Bitcoin. Because what people need the paper money for is not the glorious pictures of their glorious leaders who destroyed the currency and put their picture on it. That's not why people buy the paper money. They use it because at least it's untraceable. Now, that brings us to the real important properties of Bitcoin. It's not that it is digital. The important important thing about Bitcoin is that it's uncensorable and that it is hard money, that you can't just print Bitcoin and that you can't stop anybody from using Bitcoin or nobody can stop you. So if central banks are going to copy anything from Bitcoin other than the digital aspects, which they already have, are they going to really introduce payments methods and networks and currencies that have cryptographic validity, that determine payments validity cryptographically? Meaning that if you have the private key to your account, you can send it to somebody else, and that's and nobody can stop you. Are central banks going to do that? No, that's against their entire reason to exist. Similarly, are central banks going to go ahead and implement hard money? No, of course not. Or implement money that whose monetary supply is just completely fixed, determined algorithmically? No, the whole point of central banks, again, is to increase the money and is to set the money supply and to determine it. So it's completely against the central bank's mission to introduce a currency that actually copies Bitcoin in terms of being cryptographic determined and algorithmically determined monetary supply. So I don't see them copying it. I see them continuing to issue all sorts of silly press releases and projects where they hire a bunch of consultants who are going to tell them, you know, here's how you can make the better Bitcoin. They're going to waste a lot of money on these con artists. But at the end of the day, with digital coins, which, like, say, the Venezuelan government, which nobody really knows what they've done with it. I don't think they've introduced anything yet. And I'm not sure it's even trading on the on any kind of actual platform. All that it's doing is that it's just more and more advertisement for Bitcoin and what Bitcoin is and what Bitcoin offers. And, you know, why are all of these people doing these coins based on what Bitcoin did? More and more people are going to get curious, and they're not going to be satisfied with the answers that their government's going to bring them. So, you know, the good thing about Bitcoin is that it's going to essentially win because it is better, whether you like it or not. And so when you try and fight it, you know, if you try and fight something that's superior to you, you're just going to strengthen their superiority over you and weaken yourself. You know, if you're stronger than me and I pick a fight with you, then all that's going to happen is that you're going to kick my ass and I'm going to get weaker and you're going to get stronger. You know, so Bitcoin, you know, it can sit there and just grow because people hear about it slowly, or it can have people pick a fight with it, try and take it on, in which case, you know, they're just going to get their asses kicked. And generally, this is why this is the two good advantages of shitcoins is that, you know, for all of their scammy marketing, they are doing a massive marketing job. You know, the people behind Ethereum have the best marketing of any sort of digital project over the last 10 years or so. And I'm no expert in marketing, but this is what people I know tell me about it. You know, the way they marketed, the way they bought the press, because clearly, I mean, this whole thing is just purely hype. It's marketing. So a lot more people have heard about Bitcoin because of the Ethereum scammers going around and telling people about their smart contract, the Rube Goldberg machine. And over time, you know, yeah, some people are going to come in for the Ethereum scam, others are going to come in for the Ripple scam, others are going to come in for the EOS scam. One after another, all these scams are just going to attract more and more people. And eventually, the coins themselves are hyperinflationary. They're going to continue to produce more coins. Or the coins in aggregate are hyperinflationary. That the notion of this app coin or this Bitcoin killer or something or the other, there's nothing stopping anyone from making the next Ethereum and the next EOS, and that's what Ethereum is. So, you know, it's stupid games with stupid prizes, as we always say. But there's nobody stopping anybody from starting their own stupid game. So there's going to be hyperinflation in stupid games, and the stupid prizes are just going to get less and less worthwhile or more worthless over time. And so, you know, over time, people are going to wise up to the fact that, okay, maybe I should get out of this scam. Or they're going to just witness their wealth disappear that they put into these scams. In the long run, the net result of it is just going to be, yeah, the scammers will have made money, but eventually it's just going to attract more and more people into Bitcoin. And on the issue of scammers making money, you know, you have to remember these kind of people, if you're the sort of person who's getting into these kinds of projects, you're most likely a very high time preference person. You are making this, getting into a scam that is going to fool people out of money worldwide, putting your name and face on a website, that, and you know you're not going to deliver anything, but you are going to walk away from it with tens of millions of dollars and, you know, pretend like you're just, you know, you've succeeded in it. It's not a smart thing to do. It's a really stupid thing to do, because all it takes is one person being angry at your scam coin not delivering, and then, you know, you have to live your entire life in fear. And for me, that is not worth any kind of money. And that's why I would never join a scam coin. You know, it's not just about loyalty to Bitcoin, and it's not just, you know, a virtuous action, but, you know, virtuous actions go along with intelligence in the long run. So yeah, you think you're smart because you've made $5 million peddling a shitcoin now, but I wouldn't take the downside of spending the rest of your life worried about people who are angry at you for that. I would not take it for any amount of money. And so these kinds of people who make these kind of short-term decisions are likely to reinvest their money into all kinds of stupid games later on. So I can't really see them surviving with a lot of profit from these scams. So even the people behind them are not going to benefit from them, and they will collect stupid prizes, I believe, in the end. And the other good thing about altcoins is a lot of these people would have entered into Bitcoin. And, you know, just because I think the best argument for altcoins is that if we didn't have altcoins, if for some reason, and it's kind of hard to believe given the nature of Bitcoin, but if for some reason it was not possible to fork Bitcoin into others, then imagine if all of these shitcoiners were working on Bitcoin at this point. It's sad, but, you know, you would expect that Bitcoin development would be far more stupid and far more short-sighted and far more risky than it is right now if we had all these other developers working on it. The fact that all these people first, usually most of, well, I don't know if it's most, but a lot of altcoiners initially come into Bitcoin with their retarded ideas and, you know, hey, we were going to fix Bitcoin by adding my new suite of buzzwords to it. And then they get butthurt because nobody listens to them. And then they go and launch their own scam coin. This is a wonderful immune system mechanism that Bitcoin has. And, you know, long may it continue. It's sad to see all these shitcoins proliferate, but, you know, Bitcoin doesn't care.
And I guess all of the development of shitcoins, whether by private teams or by national governments, eventually, no matter how many more thousands we see being built in the next 5, 10, 15 years, the battle against Bitcoin by a fiat money or a digital cryptocurrency of some sort is just hopelessly asymmetric. Eventually, your stupid game will be lost. There's no way to win. You might as well at least consider for a brief period of time joining a game that you can win, and dare I say it, almost can't lose, by hodling, building, doing anything involved with Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the reason for that, I mean, we may sound a little too aggressive in insisting on this, you and I, but I think, so maybe I'll just say a couple of words from my book, from chapters 3 and 4. About the history of monetary competition and why I think Bitcoin has a very good chance to be the winner in this. It's simply about the hardness of the money, meaning the hardness of producing it in response to increases in demand for it. That's really, in my opinion, what is the most important factor in what gets chosen as money. And there are many, many examples of what happens when several forms of money interact or two forms of money interact in the same place at the same time. And what ends up happening is that the harder money gains value over time, the easier money loses value over time, at which the value of the easy money collapses entirely. So, and then it just loses its monetary role. So this is what happened to seashells once islands that used seashells had more and more gold come into it. People who would put their money in seashells started witnessing the value of the seashells collapse because modern civilization was able to produce a lot more seashells than it could produce gold. Gold is much harder to produce than seashells. And so over time, people started recognizing this, value moved from seashells to gold, and then the value of seashells collapsed. and now seashells are purely ornamental, not monetary anywhere in the world. Similar thing happened with silver in the 19th century. The only reason silver maintained any monetary value under while gold was there, and this is an important point for the people who tell you shitcoin X is going to be Bitcoin silver. And the point is, the only reason silver was gold silver was because of the visibility problem of gold. You couldn't just divide a gold coin down to small, tiny fractions. And so it was inconvenient to have gold in very small grains. And so for smaller values, it made sense to use silver. But once we got into a point where the majority of payments were not done with physical coins, but with monetary instruments and paper backed by the physical gold or silver, there was no point in keeping silver as money at all. And so at that point, more wealth started going into gold because gold was harder. And then the value of silver, and it was really, the tipping point was in 1870 when Germany switched from the silver standard to the gold standard. And that was a tipping point because when it was almost even in terms of the size of the economies that were there, but once Germany moved from one side to the other, the gold side was far more valuable. And so other countries began to move. And so you see that the price of silver against gold had historically, for as far back as anybody can remember, it has always been something like 12 to 1 or 14 to 1. In other words, 14 ounces of silver per ounce of gold or something like that, which is roughly the ratio of their differing abundance in Earth, from what I understand. And so this was the price ratio for a very, very long time. And then once Germany switched in 1870 from gold to silver, the price of silver just continued to collapse next to gold. And it is somewhere in the 50s, 60s, or 70s today. And in my opinion, you know, contrary to what a lot of hard money advocates want to believe, silver has not been money since 1870. It's now been almost 150 years that silver has been demonetized. And people who have believed that silver has held the monetary role have suffered massively from that. You know, and most particularly, the best examples of that are China and India, were the last two countries to go off the silver standard. Because of this, you know, they were holding on to silver in 1870, whose value by the turn of the century had collapsed by significant percentages. I don't have them in front of me now, but they are mentioned in my book. So, you know, this is what people need to understand. Gold did not become money because of some evil banker conspiracy. And silver did not get demonetized because, you know, for whatever the government deciding it, or government deciding they want to not make this money, as some conspiracy theorists used to think. You know, silver was the common man's money, and government, by demonetizing it, is screwing over the common man and helping out gold owners, which are the richer men. That's not the case. The reason that gold killed silver's monetary role is that gold is better, harder money. And silver is weaker, easier money, easier to produce. Silver supply grows much quicker every year, and so gold is a better store of value. And once the need for silver as a small payment mechanism was lost, silver lost its entire monetary role. There is never any good reason for there to be a second form of money. And in fact, you know, people who look at the world today, one of the stupidest things that shitcoin promoters like to say is, I think it was Naval. I'm going to name him because he deserves it. He's promoted enough shitcoins to deserve to be named. One of the stupidest things that shitcoiners have said is what Naval said once, which is, our idea of there being only one money is probably just because government monopoly enforces a one money. And that's remarkably stupid because, you know, if we didn't have governments imposing their own monies across the world, we'd have just one money across the entire world instead of that. We wouldn't have 500 currencies in the US and 200 currencies in England and 700 currencies across the world, as the shitcoiners dream, you know, the same shitcoiners who are selling you those coins. No, in a market, everybody has a very strong incentive to join the biggest money. And so the bigger the network, the bigger the incentive to migrate to the biggest money, the one that is most liquid. And this is a game that is winner take all. And all the examples you will find from history of it not being a winner-take-all market, it was either because of technical problems, like, say, silver's use for small payments, or it was because of government enforcement, government forcing it. But in our world today, we've gotten over all of these technical problems. We don't need them. And, you know, we can make everything digital, things that are divisible and in any scale that we want. And we, you know, if your shitcoin doesn't have an army to go around throwing people in jail for not paying their taxes in it, I'm sorry, but it's not going to attract any demand away from Bitcoin. Sure, your marketing plan and all of your buzzwords that you sell might get you some people to buy it. But, you know, you can't keep marketing forever, and you can't just survive on marketing forever.
And I think for a lot of prominent Bitcoiners in this space, even a majority of people outside of Bitcoin, the key to understanding Bitcoin maximalism is understanding how monies compete. And I don't necessarily want to name him, but there is a very prominent Bitcoin evangelist who's written books and speaks all around the world and so forth, who, going back to our discussion about anarchy and the development of language, particularly, compares money to language and how there's no need for one language. We probably will never only have one global language. And according to him, in the same way, we'll probably never have one global money. Can you break down that analogy for me for a minute and explain why you disagree in the comparison between money and language?
No, I disagree with that, because I think in the case of language, there are obviously advantages for learning languages that more and more people speak. However, there are also advantages for learning languages that your ancestors spoke. So there's the important thing from knowing a language is, you know, it's one of the important things is that it is able to pass on wisdom from the ages, from your family, from what your parents and grandparents have learned over the years. And so, you know, our culture, our music, our religious texts, everything that is important to making us human, our art, our all of these things that have been passed down, you know, our literature, our science, all of that stuff has been passed down and written in many languages. And that's going to continue to create more and more demand for them. And so there's a personal and cultural aspect to language, which requires you to, which is going to always make it very hard for people to give up on their language. So what I would think is a more likely scenario is that everybody will speak one language plus one more. Everybody will speak one language in common, most likely English, and I think we're seeing this emerge right now. But I think as everybody in the world begins to speak English, everybody in the world can then focus their second language skills on learning their local language, the one where you can, you know, dance to your local music and read the ancient scriptures about your glorious homeland or whatever. So I think this cultural part of language is going to is going to survive. There's no way, for instance, the Arabic language is going to be forgotten when there are 1.5 billion Muslims around the world who still recite it every day in their prayers. Well, not all of them pray, but I mean, a lot of people will continue to have its importance for it. So I think languages can survive much more than currencies. There's absolutely no reason for you to want to be part of a smaller currency than another one. Particularly because it's liquid. It's not like, you know, if your ancestors passed you down wealth in the form of silver bars, you know, you're stuck with these silver bars forever. You can go and trade them for gold or Bitcoin or whatever at any point in time. So the notion that we can make this comparison, I think, is just it's another example of just how much people have become incapable of thinking properly and just thinking with analogies. And, you know, if you can come up with an analogy for anything and say that this is like that and therefore this, but no, you said it's like that and you assume and conclude it's like that, and then that doesn't follow. So I don't really see that to be accurate. I think money, there is a much bigger value to money. The value of money increases the more liquid it is. So if you have a currency that you can only spend in your town of 100,000 people, versus a currency that you can spend in the rest of the world, you'd rather, if you're given the choice of getting paid in these, you're going to take the one that allows you more liquidity, always. And so this is a game that cannot have silver medals. It does not give out prizes for second prize. You know, this is, second prize is over. So, and I think, you know, look at gold in the 19th century. This was what the free market did. By 1900, everywhere in the world used money, used gold as money, more or less. That's what a free market wants. And that's what we would have if it weren't for governments enforcing things. And I think now, you know, this period, this notion of a foreign exchange market where different countries have their own currencies, plus we have all these new digital currencies, plus we have gold and silver still around, I think it's confused a lot of people into what it is that makes money and what it is that makes money important. And, you know, it's going to sound really outlandish for me to say it, that all of this mess is going to settle down with one winner, and that one winner is not going to be your shitcoin. But, well, if I were to say, I mean, I think this is the case, but if I were to say, I'm not really sure that Bitcoin is necessarily going to win. I always say, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And I would possibly say that I think gold would still maintain a monetary role, even if Bitcoin were to destroy every other currency. I think gold is so far so deep a part of our common psyche as a human race. It is so embedded in our culture as a dowry, as and part of many religious contracts, for instance, that have to be paid in gold. I think people will continue to value it. Plus, the fact that it's very hard money, you know, even if Bitcoin becomes harder money, gold is still pretty hard, means that its supply won't really be inflated very quickly. And so I'm not sure it's going to lose its monetary role. So we might end up with one, maybe two winners, but the notion that we're going to have a diverse, beautiful garden of currencies where everybody's own little currency continues to survive is silly. I think it's projecting political ideals onto monetary systems to which they don't apply.
Absolutely. Gold is very much the silver to Bitcoin, because gold has an abundance of properties that are still very useful and will continue to be valuable. And Bitcoin has many, if not all of those, plus a handful of others that gold does not have. Gold won't lose its value. It will just be sort of second place to Bitcoin. We're sort of a little bit past the ideal time limit of 30 minutes for these episodes. I do want to close with a couple questions for you, though, somewhat open-ended questions. Your academic papers, your book, your tweets, your lectures are known for being very audacious and bold in your assertions about the future success of Bitcoin at the cost of these other...
Not really, actually. I mean, I'm audacious in like dismissing people and in calling people names, because it's an excellent way to save time. It's an excellent productivity hack. You know, when somebody is wasting their time on the internet, call them a fucking moron, and you have more time to work. And I think, you know, it's people who tell me that, you know, you should be behaving better on the internet are completely wrong. It's having a Twitter account is not like being an elected official. I don't owe people my time. I use it, and I'm not a product, you know. I don't intend to be there because I'm on Twitter. You know, I need to go and entertain other people because they signed up for a Twitter account. I'm not getting paid for this. I do this for my own benefit and entertainment. And so, you know, I simply don't have to waste time on people that I don't want to waste time on. And this notion that you need to remain open for other people's idea is ridiculous, because there's an infinite amount of ideas out there. There's an infinite amount of people with different perspectives who want to sit and waste your entire day telling you about their perspective. And you would absolutely get nothing done in your entire life if you wanted to remain open to everybody. And in fact, you know, the way that human knowledge advances is that we establish facts and basis and move on and build upon them. Yes, you question them occasionally. You go back, and you always, of course, you have to keep an open mind. But, you know, you don't keep an open mind in terms of like an open sewer where you just let anybody come and take a dump in it just because, you know, you have to keep it open. No, an open mind means that you run your mind for yourself. You do the things you want to do. You use your mind to further your understanding. And yeah, you can talk to others, and you choose to get exposed to new ideas. But the point is, I choose how to get exposed to new ideas. So, you know, I've spent 20, 25 years now reading economics and politics and all of that stuff, and to be able to come at my ideas. I'm sorry, but if you're going to come at me and tell me, you know, from a Marxist perspective that, you know, I'm wrong about things, there is no way that 280 character sized bytes of dumb progressive or Marxist snark is going to change my mind. You know, I've read millions of pages over my life of stuff. And sorry, I'm not going to waste my afternoon because you decided to waste yours throwing your snark at me and trying to get me to change my mind. And so I do call people idiots, although I've stopped calling them idiots now and just resorted to muting and blocking, which is also another effective way. But I'm completely unapologetic about it. My Twitter's following has increased drastically. And, you know, for people who have a few followers on Twitter, you know, they think they use it like Facebook, where they just throw in the first brain fart that comes into many. I mean, obviously not all of them, but they think, you know, it can be used like Facebook, where you're just you and your family and friends and you're sharing funny comments. So I get a ton of comments every day from people just that add nothing, you know, lol, or ha ha ha, that's funny, or, you know, this is completely stupid, I can't believe you would say it. This is my favorite, the sort of entirely outraged person who, you know, thinks I am so outraged, and if I tell you that I'm outraged with you, then you're going to change your mind about my perspective. And it's just spam. It's no different than email spam for me, so I shut it all away. But, you know, I wouldn't say that to go back to your original point, I wouldn't say that I'm 100% sure that Bitcoin is going to succeed. I don't. I'm not. I don't think Bitcoin is necessarily going to win. I think there's a very strong possibility. Why? And I explain why in my book. But, you know, the future is unknowable. And I'm not writing off something unknowable to us changing things.
Sure. No, that's more than fair. I'm curious, given the robustness and the strength of the opinions that you hold, which critics, or if you maybe even want to label them as opponents to the ideas you hold, which contrary voices you respect, no matter how much you disagree with them, relevant to the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and even the so-called blockchain space? Is there one or two persons that you can think of that you disagree with on almost everything, but nonetheless still respect or will lend an ear to?
Yes, Vitalik Buterin. No, I'm kidding, of course. Definitely nobody from any of the shitcoins. They have absolutely nothing interesting to say, and I've blocked and muted every single person who promotes the shitcoin that comes across my timeline. So it's definitely not from the shitcoin world, and it's not from the government shitcoin world. Definitely none of the Keynesian economists who think they're offering valuable critiques. And really, there aren't any valuable critiques in that way. I mean, there haven't been valuable studies done as to why Bitcoin offer good critiques of Bitcoin. What we have is just media whores and the sort of spokespersons for the terrible government monetary policy. The academics who are responsible for propagating stupid Keynesian ideas, they get on TV and they say a few buzzwords and a few canned lines about, you know, Bitcoin is going to die and Bitcoin is going to collapse. So none of these have offered anything interesting. I think the most interesting criticisms of Bitcoin and the most, the ones that are the most reasoned, because they understand money, come from gold bugs. And not all gold bugs, obviously. You know, a lot of the gold bugs are gold bugs because of some sort of fetish to the physical properties of gold, which I find completely ridiculous. It's not about gold's shininess or anything like that that makes the money. It's just its economic properties, the fact that its supply is very hard to increase. So from that perspective, people who understand that can offer the best criticisms of Bitcoin. And I think I'm not entirely convinced of this criticism, but it is really the one that I would say is the hardest for me to satisfy myself that I answered. And it goes back to the issue of volatility of gold and the stability of gold. I understand how Mises actually would agree. If you were to look at Mises, you would say that Bitcoin is even better than the jewelry demand would probably be better than one that did, which is the case of gold. And while that might be right theoretically, and Bitcoin might have that advantage, I think the best criticism I've received against Bitcoin is the fact that, currently maybe, 10 million, 50 million people around the world hold Bitcoin. If we're going to go from, say, 10 million to 7 billion people holding Bitcoin, the volatility is not something that can that is going to go away easily, and it's something that, you know, gold, because of its 6,000-year first mover advantage, is going to have as a benefit, because gold is so far widespread. So many people have gold all over the world that individual fluctuations in supply or demand don't really matter towards the price. The purchasing power of gold remains largely constant, even though we might see the gold price oscillating in the short run. In the long run, it's remarkably stable. I mean, the price of a cow has almost always been around 1 ounce of gold for about as far as anybody can remember, somewhere around that range. And so I think that will continue for a very long time. So Bitcoin might continue to rise as an investment asset that people continue to hold. And this rise will lead to the collapse of more and more currencies as people move out of, say, the Venezuelan and the Zimbabwe dollar. Even if Bitcoin kills all the fiat currencies, I'm not 100% convinced that it could kill gold. And I'm not convinced that it would it would gain, you know, a total monetary dominance, because, you know, gold has a 6,000-year advantage. So I would say this is really the best the best argument I receive against gold, against Bitcoin. I'm sorry.
No, that makes sense. And perfect time to mention, even though we don't have time to unpack it today, the article you wrote for the Journal of Structured Finance on whether Bitcoin's volatility can be tamed and whether seeing volatility potentially as a feature instead of maybe a deleterious characteristic to Bitcoin. An incredible short read that I very much appreciated hearing your thoughts on. Very, very timely, especially now given the latest bubble that's captured headlines like it always does.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for chatting with me. I really can't thank you enough. It's been a pleasure, phenomenal experience on my end, and I can't wait for my listeners to hear our conversation. Thanks so much, Zachy.
Thank you so much, Zachy. It was a lot of fun for me, too.